Welcome to Deep Talk, the podcast for advanced English learners who are looking to explore something a little bit deeper. My name's Rhiannon and I'm an English coach. Each week I invite a different guest onto the show and they choose a text or video they've really loved recently. Together we talk about the ideas and we invite you to join in on the Deep Talkers Facebook group. You'll find the links to the text we discuss in the description to this podcast, along with all the links to get involved. Welcome to episode 17 of Deep Talk. We've got an extra long episode today, so I'll keep this intro as waffle-less as possible. Today I'm speaking with Dave about the perceptual phenomenon synesthesia, which both he and I have. If you've never heard of it before, you are in for a wild ride, because one of the most common things people who don't have it say is, how on earth can this be a real thing? But it is, and it is awesome. We chat about what it is and the things scientists have learned about it over the years, plus how it manifests for us personally and why we love it so much. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and please, if you are a synesthete or know someone who is, please, please, please message me to tell me. I love hearing about different people's experiences with it. Anyway, for now, enjoy episode 17. Our guest this week is Dave. Dave is an artist. He's currently in his second year of a two-year part-time artist's residency at a school here in Edinburgh, as well as working at the National Galleries of Scotland. Art is not his main source of income, and he likes it that way. He thinks the pressure to make money from it would be highly detrimental to his work. He's had shows in Edinburgh, Glasgow, and around the UK, and is going to be part of an upcoming show at the National Portrait Gallery here in Edinburgh, in an exhibition titled Artists at Work 2. In his spare time, when he's not going to art galleries or reading about art, he enjoys learning about the natural world. He loves getting outside in the countryside, walking and running and taking photographs outdoors, as well as spending time on the coast, which he loves having easy access to from Edinburgh, having grown up in Derbyshire, many miles from the sea. Dave, first of all, welcome to Deep Talk. It is such a pleasure to have you here.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. You have picked such an interesting topic for us today, and one I'm really looking forward to talking about. And I'll just quickly tell listeners that, unlike usual episodes where we focus on a particular text or video, we've decided this week to put a whole bunch of resources in the episode description, and we're just going to talk a bit more broadly. So Dave, can you tell us what we're talking about this week?
Yes. So we're going to be talking about a thing called synesthesia, which, so I'm not sure what it's classed as, a neurological condition
thing
or phenomenon. I don't know. Yeah. But you and I both have it,
in a different way
as well. So yeah, we're going to talk through, I guess, what is synesthesia, a bit about the science of it, and then yeah, go on to our own personal experiences.
Excellent. Yeah, so for somebody who has never heard of this before, how would you define it, or how would a professional define it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I'll do my best. So I think I actually looked up the definition of the word, and synesthesia means union of the senses.
Right.
And effectively what it is people with synesthesia, and many people who have synesthesia don't know that they have synesthesia. It's just kind of ordinary to them. But basically, I think the premise is, when one part of your brain is stimulated, another part is involuntarily stimulated. And often that's one sensory experience, and sometimes often colour is the other one that's stimulated. So, for example, with myself, every letter of the alphabet, when I think of that letter, I almost see it in my mind's eye, and it's always in a specific colour. So each letter is different, although some is the same colour for different letters. The same with numbers as well. And then you get onto words, and it gets a bit more kind of complex because you're mixing letters together. So yeah, that's kind of the premise of it. But I was trying to find out if there is an exact list of how many types there are, but there seems to vary what the internet says, but at least over 70 different combinations.
Yeah, the number I found was something like 72.
Yeah, yeah.
Seems very specific. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting, because mine is, and I always forget which way it goes round, but spatial sequence or sequence spatial. I can't remember which one it is.
Yeah.
So for me, the really strong one, and I do have, I think I probably have other synesthesias as well, but this is the one that stands out the most for me, which is when I get, for example, numbers or dates or the alphabet, anything that has a sequence, I see that in space. So that has a kind of almost a three-dimensional, not, you know, I'm not hallucinating. I was talking to Claire, my girlfriend, about this, and like she just really couldn't understand what I meant about seeing. She was like, so you so you're hallucinating. I was like, no, I know it's not there, but I can see it. It has a shape, it has a form, I could draw it.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's my synesthesia.
Yeah, I mean, similar to you. So the main one for me is, I think it's called grapheme color. So your graphic numericals and letters. But I've had other experiences with, so another big one is sound and colors. So people hear certain musical notes or sounds, and that either elicits a color in their head or a shape and a color. And there's one of those, I think one of my strongest experiences with that was, I can't remember if I told you this, but I was walking down a corridor and, is it Walk of Life or Walk for Life by Dire Straits?
Walk of Life. Yeah.
And that intro guitar bit, it's like I saw this kind of hurricane above my head. But for that split second, like you talk about seeing it, it's like for a fraction of a second, I wasn't in the corridor. There was just that thing in front of me. But then for a second, you're out again. So you're right. It's not really a hallucination, but it still takes over your head for a second or something like that.
Yeah. It is. And it's really, so I watched, you kind of sent a ton of resources, and I watched a video, which I will link in the episode description. And it's a presentation by Julia Simner, who is one of the kind of big names. Like she comes up a lot in like bibliographies on articles about this. And she's giving a talk, and there was something she quoted, one of her, I was going to say test subjects. Is that the right word?
I think subject is the word. Yeah.
Okay.
Participants.
Yeah. Participants. As saying, like, something had changed. He was describing his sequence synesthesia. And what he noticed was that the usual pattern of a century starting in one place and then ending towards him and then going back to the beginning hadn't happened when at the change of the kind of to the 21st century.
Oh, right. So okay.
2001 had kind of continued in the same direction instead of doing what it normally did with 1901 and 1801 of like going back to the beginning. And he described it, and I'm forgetting the exact words, as like, I don't make the rules. Like I didn't make that happen. It just happened to me.
Yeah.
And that's very much how I see, because I'll sometimes try to like manipulate my shape of the sequence, and I'll be like, what would happen if it went this way? And my brain is just like, nope, it doesn't work. Doesn't compute. It must turn left at that point or whatever it is.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with that, with the letters and the colors. Cause when I think about a word, often a certain letter in the word will dominate the rest of the word, or two of them maybe. So the word might only be one or two colours, even though it's made up of lots of letters with lots of different colours. Mm-hmm. And again, I can't tell you why that colour is the dominant colour. Like, it just is. And like, there's no arguing with it or changing it. Like,
I'm interested with this like grapheme colour, because to a certain extent, and I always sort of thought I had it until I realised that my colours are really, really inconsistent. I probably don't have it. But with individual letters, I can see colours there. Like, it seems, I can understand how that. But does this work for you, like, with every single word? Or are there some words where you would be drawn to seeing those colours and other words would just kind of remain in the background and kind of grey? Like, how does this work?
No, I think every single word is always stands out. I mean, there are probably like a third of the letters of the alphabet for me are like white or a creamy color, so they're kind of not as strong. Like the word you, for example, YOU, like all of those letters are white in my synesthesia, but maybe U's slightly grey and O's slightly yellow or something. So it's kind of less exciting than, whereas I don't know, for me the word because is kind of B's blue, E's pink, A's red. Yeah, so you've got all these kind of colours going on, and that word, I don't know, kind of becomes this very strong purpley red colour or something like that. It's got a lot of, like, I think some letters seem to override others, like A is red, R is blue, S is yellow, they're somehow stronger than other right. letters, I feel like. So sometimes when they're in the word, they just kind of take over the word.
That's really interesting, because in the talk, Julia Simner was saying that there are these rules, and I had never heard this before
right.
looking at this, before watching that video. There are some kind of rules, and it tends that, like, the more common the letter, the brighter colour.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was particularly interested because I wondered if the same thing would hold up for alphabets which have, like, different, more common letters. So I'm thinking, I don't know, some, like, Eastern European alphabets that have Z quite a lot, whereas in English, Z is a very uncommon letter. Would that be reflected in there? So I'm really interested. I mean, I don't have the statistics, but that I think would be a really fun thing to explore. And does the same thing happen with, like, non-alphabet languages? So, like, Arabic or Mandarin, like, do different symbols have colours for synesthetes who have grown up speaking those languages?
Yeah. No, that's a really interesting question. So the person from Edinburgh University you're talking about there, so when I... just go back in time, when I came to Edinburgh University, they'd sent an email out to all the students being like, do you have this synesthesia? And I responded to it because they were doing maybe we can get a bit sciencey for a minute, but they're doing some research with the University of Sussex looking for a gene or genes that might be related to synesthesia. But and to take part in that, you had to prove that you have synesthesia, because anyone could say that they have synesthesia. I suppose one of the things to start, and we've already talked about this, is A, it's involuntary, so you don't have any control of it. Mm-hmm. But B, the other thing is it's consistent. So your shapes for your dates or my colours for my letters, like, they'll always be the same. So it's not one colour today and another colour tomorrow or something like that. So that one of the tests that I had to do was showing every letter of the alphabet three times in random order. And there's kind of a colour palette on the computer screen, and you have to pick the colour. You had to be very detailed with the colour you picked. It wasn't just, like, you know, red, blue,
the
green.
The primaries,
It was just lots of shades. And every time you selected, the colour palette would shift, so the position of the colours would change. So effectively, if you have synesthesia, you know, you should get a really high score on this because it's always consistent. Anyway, what you were talking about kind of non, you know, different alphabets and things like that. I remember one of the questions on the, once you'd kind of proven you had synesthesia, there's big surveys you had to do to help them with their research. And one of the questions was, do you experience synesthesia for other alphabets? Which, I mean, I can't speak in any other kind of alphabet language, so I couldn't say. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, surely in theory.
Very fascinating.
Because it's the part of your brain, in the grapheme colour one, it's the part of your brain that's to do with language. It's the part of the brain that's to do with colour. So surely whichever your language you speak, it's still the same part of your brain that's been used, and that connection therefore must exist. But what you said about languages where different letters are used more regularly, like Z, for example, that'd be really interesting.
Yeah, the reason I think about it is I remember I went to, like, a games cafe with my ex-girlfriend when we lived in Germany, and there was Scrabble, and she spoke Spanish and I spoke English, and we were just given a whole bunch of letters that don't exist, like, hardly ever come up in Spanish or English. And we were like, oh, wow, they change the number of, like, A's and O's and W's in different language Scrabbles. That had never occurred to me.
There you go.
Yeah. And I wondered if a similar thing was happening with synesthetes. Also, there was a guy that she talked about in this talk who had, what was it? Like, maybe grapheme or, like, word taste? Like,
yes,
grapheme gustatory or something.
That's it, yeah.
And he would taste words, and words would generate a flavour in his mouth. And the part of his brain that generated, that kind of lit up when you taste something, was being lit up. And that's the really exciting thing, that this isn't just in our heads in a fake way, it's in our heads in a real way, like the part of our brain that, for me, the part of my brain that deals with shape is lit up when think about sequences. He was, sorry, just to finish my point, his taste profiles for different words were highly influenced by the kind of flavors that he ate most often, particularly when he was younger.
Right,
so he had a lot of flavors that came up in like kind of sweets and chocolate from his youth. So it's really interesting how it's there are rules, but they're also highly influenced by your context.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe to go back to some of the science of it, I listened to some of that talk. The bit you're talking about brains, yeah, so the kind of biology of synesthesia, as it were, I think, is that effectively a person with synesthesia has extra connections in their brain, or what in that talk she said white matter. I don't know what that is, but it's obviously a connective thing. So when one part of the brain is stimulated, there's an automatic stimulation somewhere else. And those connections don't exist in people without synesthesia.
Yeah.
Hence why it's an involuntary association that takes place as well, because you're not in control of it, it's just happening. But then also the other part of the brain is, with these brain scans, is the grey matter, which is the, I might be wrong here, the bit that does the thinking. So people with synesthesia, they have, so say you've got a colour synesthesia, the grey matter for colour is denser than someone without synesthesia.
Yeah, from what I understood. I mean, I opened that talk expecting to kind of flick through it, and it was so fascinating. I just watched all 50 minutes yesterday.
Yeah.
I was like, this is really interesting. And I think the predominant theory at the moment, I think you've described it to me, and I've seen it elsewhere, as this kind of banana, bunch of bananas theory. But the idea that when babies are born, they actually have incredibly dense gray matter. Everything is really connected. Like, people are born with these multiple, and she was saying that, like, as young children and babies, almost everyone is probably a synesthete. That's the current theory.
Yeah.
And then as they grow older, these kind of connections are broken, and in synesthetes, they're just not. For whatever reason, they're just not broken.
Yeah. Again, just some of the more biology I read. They did studies with identical twins, and so we're going back to the genes thing. They think the genes that associate with it are actually, when your brain develops and these kind of cuts take place between connecting things, some of these genes, that doesn't quite stops that from happening, or it doesn't happen. But yeah, because also you were talking about environmental kind of influences and stuff. Like the identical twins, both with synesthesia, but they'll see different colours for the same letters, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's not 100% genetic. Or two identical twins where one has it and one doesn't have it.
Right.
So they're supposedly genetically identical, but one of them, it's not kind of manifested in one of them. So I think this is interesting, what they're trying to find out with the research is it's not as simple as you're born with it or you're not born with it. There's an environmental early development, childhood kind of plays a role in it somehow.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and I think we talked about like family members with it. So another thing, there is genes involved that they're pretty sure of. So it's, you know, it is you can inherit it, but it can often skip generations, or a parent might have one type of synesthesia and the child might have a different type of synesthesia, or maybe your parents don't have it but your cousin has it, or something like that. So
yeah, I remember, so the reason that I thought that I had the graphene color one, and I haven't done a test, so the reason that we're talking about this at all on this podcast,
we should bring this up,
is that me and Dave were having dinner. I was around at Dave and his girlfriend's house a couple of weeks ago with my partner, and it was probably getting to about the time where everyone's thinking, we've got to get up tomorrow, we should probably go home. And then for whatever reason, this topic came up, and suddenly both our partners are silent for half an hour while me and Dave go, oh yeah, and also, oh, and this, and did you do that? And da, 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 da. But yeah, the reason that I thought I had it was that I remember vividly me, my brother and my dad playing a game when we were younger, which was like, what colour's Monday? And we all had to shut our eyes and see Monday and then go, it's yellow. And then we'd have a fight about it because Owen my brother would think it was like purple and I'd think it was yellow and he would think it. And like, that's so I think even if we don't necessarily pass the test, I think for in our family there is very much an awareness that obviously words have color, obviously, even if they're not always consistent, which I think is really interesting, because I say that to like my partner, who is probably the direct opposite of a synesthete. She doesn't get it at all. And she's like, what on earth do you mean Monday's yellow? That doesn't mean anything. And I'm like, how does it not mean anything?
It's just obviously
yellow. How did you like realize that you seeing colour wasn't what everybody else saw.
Yeah, and I think this is a good point I made earlier, that there's a lot of people who might go through life with synesthesia not realising that it's not how everyone else thinks.
Yeah.
And I think with the research, it's approximately they think about 4% of the population have synesthesia, which is like 1 in 25 people. So, I mean, if you're in a supermarket or something, the odds are someone in there, if it's not you, someone else in there is like, got it.
Yeah.
I remember it very clearly too, because it was kind of like a oof, like moment. I was probably 17, maybe 18. I was at secondary school in like registration, and I was talking to someone in my form group, and she was talking about it. And I was saying, I do that as well. And she was like, you know, that's called synesthesia. It's an actual thing. It's not. And I was like, oh. And then I researched it and I was like, wow. I was like, this isn't necessarily normal, but it's completely normal to me. And this is the thing, that you kind of can't imagine life without it, because it's just the way things are. And I think it's another thing about synesthesia. It's not classed as a kind of hindrance or a disability or anything like that. It's not a negative thing, but, and we could maybe in a minute, there are some potential positive aspects to it that research has done and stuff, but it's just part of life, like having any other faculty of your body, you know, it's kind of.
Yeah, and I mean, it's sort of like that kind of philosophical question of like, do we all see red in the same way? Mm. Like, that was a point that I found really interesting in that talk, that Julia Simner was making the argument that synesthesia kind of proves that reality isn't objective, that our interpretation of reality kind of goes through these filters. Mm. And we sort of assume that the filters in my brain are working the same way as the filters in your brain, but this is kind of proof that they're not.
Definitely
always.
Not. Yeah.
And that's really interesting, I think. So tell me a little bit more about your synesthesia. Let's dive in, because I want to talk about yours, I want to talk about mine.
Yeah.
So we're talking about words, we're talking about graph, like letters, which is grapheme. Can I throw some words at you and you tell me what colour they are? Is that a test that you
would definitely
pass?
And you could try and trick me and ask me the same one a few times. But before I do that, I'll just mention there's two other kind of main subdivisions of synesthesia.
Oh, yeah.
There's associators and projectors. So I think you and I are associators, and it all happens in our head. Whereas a projector, they actually see it in the space in front of them. So whereas I think of words and letters, I see the colours in my head. A projector would actually open a book, and they would actually visually see the letters different colours on the actual page. Or maybe with your one, the sequence might be laid out in front of them in space rather than being in their mind. So it's actually interacting with the world they're seeing through their eyes. You know, basically, it's not quite a hallucination, it's just in your head.
Yeah.
So, like, that's the association thing, whereas the projectors, it's actually in the world in front of them.
Struggle to, and I think I would probably need, like, a professional to take my description and work out whether it is associative or projector, because I see it around me.
Right.
But it's not the me that is here, it's the me that's in my mind.
Yeah.
So that's like, well, it's around me, but not, like, I can use my hands to kind of move it, like it is in space, but there's no, like, it doesn't, like, the fact I have a desk in front of me isn't going to interrupt it.
Yeah, sure.
Whereas I have something which I don't know what it would be classified as, but when I was at university, somebody who, to be honest, given our ages, he was probably working on the same project you were involved in, but I just didn't know it at the time.
Really? Yeah.
He was a friend of a friend, and I remember he was doing his PhD in synesthesia. I described something that happens to me, and he went, that's synesthesia. Like, it's a part of it. And it's that whenever I walk into a room, I will automatically see what I call monkey bars, which are like in a playground where you're kind of swinging from bars. I see them and I visualize them. And if I ever go, oh, I wonder what the monkey bar thing is for this room.
Yeah.
I will realize I've already done it. I'm not having to work it out. It's like already been worked out. My brain's already got there. And so that side of thing is obviously a projector, because I'm seeing them. I'm not hallucinating them. I know they're not there, but I'm seeing them in space. And if the angle of the room is a bit complex, it will be affected by that. So that's obviously a projected thing, but that's not the same thing as the sequence. But I mean,
same with...
sound like a nut job.
I was just thinking, I wonder what your listeners are like. What are these two talking about?
This is not the deep talk we have come to know and love.
You know, with the numbers and the letters, it's really strong and consistent. And like I said, I do get it with sound as well, but less consistently. But that one, when I was, you know, talking about that tornado thing, like whenever a C shapes or colours with sound, it, although it's in my head, kind of similar maybe to what you were saying, it's also a certain scale in relation to my own body. So I know if it's bigger than me, I know if it's smaller than me, I know if it's really far away from me, or if it's really close to me, or if it's underneath me, or if it's behind me, or to my left, or to my right. So, again, I said any objects around me don't play any role in this. But, you know, I could be in an enclosed corridor and this shape could feel like it's 2 miles away or something like that. But, yeah, it's still in your head or something. So,
okay, let's do a test. All right, I'm going to throw some words
at you. I'll do my best. I'm going to close my eyes.
What colour is Monday?
Green.
Oh, it's definitely yellow.
Because M is green, so that kind of takes over.
Oh, okay. All right. Let's stick with days of the week. Thursday?
Kind of like a orangey yellow colour.
Okay. For me, it's purple. I mean, you're the professional with this particular synesthesia,
not
so we will defer to you. But it's purple for me. Sunday?
Yellow. Like a light yellow. Quite bright yellow.
It's like a really deep primary red for me. Wow. Okay. March?
Ooh. Kind of like a reddy brown, actually.
Okay. But I thought, wasn't M green?
Yeah, but then...
green hasn't played into it.
Well, this is why it surprised me, but it's the A took over there because A is red.
Oh, interesting.
And, but then I think the red and the green are mixing it. So, yeah.
Because for me, my Monday was yellow and my March is yellow. And now I think about it, I think my M is yellow as well.
Yeah.
Maybe I do have this. I need to do the test.
You should see. I should say this to any of you listeners as well. If you think you've got it, go on University of Sussex website for synesthesia, because that's where this research has been done out of. And you should do this round as well. You can do the tests, and then if you want, you can take part in their research, and you get emails from them, and they tell you what they've discovered and all this kind of stuff. So
amazing. Okay, a couple more.
Go
September.
On. Yellowy color because S is yellow. So yeah.
Oh, no, I've just realised that September is red and so is Sunday and S is red.
There you go.
Oh, I am consistent. This is so much fun. December.
Ooh, kind of like a grey, whitey orange.
Ooh, where do you think that comes from?
D is kind of like an orangey, goldy colour. So maybe it must come from that. But it's a bit lighter than a normal D. I don't know, it sounds a bit weird because it's got two E's in it, which is pink, which is really bright, and there's a B, which is blue, and the R's blue, and the M's green. But see, like, when I think of December, there's no green in it whatsoever, even though there's an M in there, for example, and there's no pink, even though there's two E's in it. So this is the thing with words, and they get a bit odd.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. My December is dark green, but it makes me think, am I just thinking Christmas? Is that, like, Christmas tones? Because I'll have seen December, like, written in, like, red and green so many times, but I don't know what D is. I find it very difficult to know what D is and what is the thing I was just thinking about, and therefore that's what D is.
No, but what you're saying is interesting, because like I was just thinking about, if you ask me what color is the word of a color, like orange, for example, like the word orange in my synesthesia is white, but obviously that's not the color, but at the same time my brain can't help thinking about the color orange at the same time, so it's so that's a bit confusing. And for me, names is kind of one where it gets a bit muddled, because if you think of a name, that can just be an independent word. But if at the same time I'm simultaneously thinking about the person's name that you're saying, then what tends to happen, I pick a colour out of one of the letters. Again, I don't do it. My brain does it. That somehow relates to the person. It's often actually their hair colour or their eye colour. So you could ask me the names. There's two people with the same name, so it's the same word, but I'll have different colours. It's always a colour derived out of the letters.
Oh, I think I've lost you. Hello? I can't hear you.
Dave.
While Dave and I sort out our tech issues, let me remind you that our Facebook group, Deep Talkers, is the perfect place to chat about the episodes, share interesting things you're reading and watching, and generally be a geeky, wonderful, curious soul in English. You'll find the link to join in the episode description. I'll see you there. Okay, we are back. We just had a little tech emergency. You will not have known, but we have just taken a 45-minute break as Dave's camera, Dave's computer updates and all that stuff. Should we talk a little bit about my synesthesia? Because I think that's one that is perhaps a little bit harder explain. If you Google, and I encourage everybody to Google this, spatial sequence or sequence spatial synesthesia, they will get a whole load of images of this kind of white outline body with this colorful weird shaped bagel donut thing outside, and that is basically sequence synesthesia. So when I think about, for example, numbers, they have a shape, so the number line has a shape, so it starts kind of it's more detailed at the beginning, as you would expect, because those are the numbers that sort of change most often. So my one, I can change perspective depending on whether I'm going into the minuses or staying in positive numbers, but my 0 and 1 start and they kind of curve around until 5, and then they start on a straight line at an angle upwards until 10. 10, 12, 11, 12, and 13 are kind of separate to the rest of the teens, probably because of the name that's like different. And then at 13, it sort of changes direction at a really steep right angle and starts coming around to the right. Then 20 changes direction, then 30 changes direction. And then from 30, it's a steady, more or less straight incline up until 100, where we take another right turn. So it's this sort of jaggedy spiral that gradually has longer and longer arms. So right at the beginning, almost every number is a slight change of direction. And then towards the end, you've got like, you know, a whole 1,000 is the same strip.
How far does it go? Like, a million to you?
A million is right at the top of the hill. And then a million would change direction into the 2 millions.
Oh, right.
So I think it sort of like compresses. So a million, like 100,000 to a million takes up almost the same amount of space as like 5 to 10.
Okay.
in my mind. But as you've said that, I usually think about million in terms of money. And system for money is ever so slightly different. So so it's sort of like, I think in thousands, it's exactly the same shape, but instead of having 100 at that top of that hill before we turn right, it's £100,000 pounds.
All right,
for going to the right. So yeah, it's exactly the same shape so far as I can work out. I think I've never really thought about that before.
Sorry, can I ask you some questions?
Yeah, please do.
What about like, if you're doing a mathematical sum in your head, like 5 plus 5 or whatever, does the synesthesia play a part in that?
Yes.
Like, you visualize those sums and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. My way of like, if we were adding like 47 and 62, I would probably be adding 40 and 60 and then 2 and 7.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Those breakdowns, I see them as like a shape.
Right. Okay.
Have you ever played Ticket to Ride?
No.
Okay. Well, the only reason that I mention it is because Ticket to Ride, when you're counting up the points, like, there's a 1 to 100 counters around the edge of the board, and you move your little piece every time you get points. And that I find really, really hard because it's not in the same shape as the timeline in my head.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so they don't distinguish between fives, whereas my fives, as in like 35, 45, are quite prominent in my within this timeline, they're quite prominent, and I use them a lot in my mental maths. So I only really think of 7 as 5 plus 2, and I don't think of them as numbers. I think of them as like those little, like a 5-shaped block plus a 2-shaped block.
Oh, wow.
God, it's so weird articulating this stuff and realizing that, oh God, this is what my brain does.
You see everything you're saying. Although I don't experience that, I don't know why, but I'm agreeing with everything you're saying because I'm like, that's how synesthesia works. Like, it just is weird stuff like that. Like,
yeah.
But it's not weird though. It's just normal.
Yeah. I had a really, I think probably in preparation for this conversation, I've been thinking about it quite a lot. And I had a really interesting realization about calendars. So my calendar runs from my right to my left. So my right is the past, my left is the future, and it goes uphill from sort of January to December. Then it sort of dips down again, but almost like a bounce, and then I'm riding back up to December again. And that's my calendar, which is slightly different to how I would think about years when I'm thinking about like 2001, 2002. Sure. That's a different kind of perspective.
Okay.
But the important thing to remember is that mine runs from right to left and it's slightly in front of where I'm standing. And I will kind of move with that. So I'm currently stood in, I'm actually currently stood in September because my brain hasn't twigged that it's October yet. But I should be stood in October, but my brain is always a couple of months behind. But I was at the gym and I was feeling a bit crap about myself because I hadn't gone to the gym in a while. And then as a sort of self-coaching thing, I was like, well, would you feel, you know, you're saying you didn't go to the gym for a week and that's therefore this huge thing. But if imaginary person from the gym came in and said, oh, I was busy last week and I didn't come to the gym, would you think anything of that? I thought, no, I wouldn't. Mm. But in that little mind exercise, I could see this stranger's calendar because I was thinking about their week. And I realized that their calendar was the other way to my calendar.
All right.
I was looking at their calendar, not my calendar, if that makes sense. So I was looking at their calendar. They were facing me. So running from left to right, going up towards December, like it was exactly the same shape, but in reverse. And it wasn't mine. And I had never realized that I do that. And I think it's because quite often when I think about other people's plans, I think about them in relation to me. Like the egocentric, self-centered person that I am. So I'm thinking, you know, one of our friends is moving house and there's been some debate about when they're going to move house. So I've been thinking, okay, is it January? Is it December? Is it November? But I'm thinking, when do I need to help them move? Like, when do I need to go and carry some boxes? So it was always from my perspective, but this stranger at the gym who I don't know, who was kind of imagining, they're not me. They're not my friend. It doesn't have any relation to me. Yeah. And therefore I saw it from a different perspective. And that was something I hadn't realized until like 2 weeks ago. So much fun.
with your own like memory, does it play a role in that? Like if you're remembering an event in the past, do you walk along that scale in any way or did you just have the memory? Synesthesia doesn't play a part in that.
Good question. No, I think it does. I think it does. If I'm thinking about 1993 and like what I would be doing in 1993, I was 2 years old, so not much, but like I am thinking about 1993 on my decades calendar.
Yeah.
But and if I'm thinking about March, I'm thinking about it on my yearly calendar.
Sure. But then if you're thinking about, say, something you did when you were, I don't know, 12 or something like that, instead of imagining what you're doing when you were two, but something you actually remember, does that feature on the timeline at all or is it just kind of separate?
I think it depends very much on whether I'm thinking about when I did it or what I did.
What it was.
The memory doesn't have any relation to time.
Right.
It's only when I go, how old was I? What year would that have been? That's when the calendar pops up.
Okay, So were you going to say something just now?
I was, because when I was researching for this podcast, I came across another form of sequence. So sequences are often thought of as months of the year, days of the week, numbers, alphabet, the really common ones. But I saw one sketch, which was somebody's synesthesia for all the Star Trek seasons.
All right.
So like Star Trek Voyager was one shape and Star Trek Next Generation was another shape. Yeah. And I realized that I studied theology and have not once read the Bible. So I'm really, and I avoided Bible studies at kind of all costs. So I don't know what the books of the Bible are, which is shameful, but I nevertheless have a shape for it. I have a shape of the Bible. Okay. And I have a shape of the Harry Potter series.
Oh yeah.
They change direction at number five. And that might be because of the kind of tone of the books change or the length of the books change. But I definitely have a shape of the Harry Potter books, which I hadn't realized until I saw that somebody had done that with Star Trek Voyager. And I went, oh, yeah, I do that too.
I do that, yeah.
Really interesting. Do you have any of that?
No, I couldn't say I have anything like that. Two things I was going to say.
Yeah.
One, not about me. when I was doing research for this, and maybe this is a broader synesthesia thing, which, maybe say what your experiences are too. Again, not quantifiably, but people with synesthesia are possibly more likely to have better skills of memory because they often associate things with the synesthesia.
Yeah, I've
heard that. Ones I'd read about was a guy who could recall pi to something like 22,000 places. And he used, a bit like what you were describing, he used his synesthesia as if he was going on a journey along pi. But in his mind, he was walking a physical route. And that's how he remembered it.
Yeah. It's like there used to be like a TV show of, there was like a conveyor belt of different items and people had to remember.
Generation Game?
Was it Generation Game?
I think so, yeah. Yeah. And the more you can remember, the more you win or something.
Yeah. And they used to go and get a little bit of training, didn't they? Like memory training from a specialist who would kind of say, sort of okay, like put it on a journey, like you're walking along and then there's an advert for a Hoover. Okay, the Hoover is one of the items. And then, so that is something that you can kind of artificially create.
Yeah.
Exactly. Kind of like Sherlock and his sort of
memory palace.
Memory palace. Yeah. That sort of thing. But obviously synesthetes are doing that much more instinctively. I think it just happens rather than something that is created.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that sort of leads us on to the next thing we want to talk about, which is like, what are the benefits of synesthesia? Mm. And you're obviously an artist.
Yeah.
Does your synesthesia relate to your art at all? Have you ever used it, made use of it?
Directly, no. Mm-hmm. I think there are, I think, if you, again, if you do an internet search or something, and the painter Kandinsky is possibly one of the contenders for this, is they actually depicted the synesthesia in their artworks.
Oh, wow.
And a bit like you were saying, if you search spatial sequencing, you get these kind of bagel drawings. Again, you can look up, there are painters who have painted certain songs or voices or, whatever it was that created the synesthesia. That's not something that I do at all. Mm-hmm. I think the thing that I read in, again, for doing some research, which interests me maybe, it was saying, yes, I'm not saying that people with synesthesia are always more creative than people without it, but it's that they're more likely to be creative. And there's a higher percentage of people with synesthesia in like art colleges where I went, for example, or in working in the arts and things like that. And one of the, I don't know if it's proven or if it's a theory, ideas is that people with synesthesia are, they kind of habitually make connections between things that don't connect in a kind of logical, obvious way. And in art, there's a lot of use of kind of metaphors or making links between concepts and ideas or people and places and ideas. So it's maybe that people with synesthesia are more disposed to make connections between things when they're not necessarily obvious or even there at all. And they're just kind of, these things go together and maybe it kind of works. So maybe, I don't know, maybe that's something I feel might, again, I can't quantifiably say this, but like, I mean, you mentioned earlier, like kind of reading about natural world and all these kind of things. I don't know. I think with your art, you're bringing in all these diverse references or subject matters, and then you're making art. You're seeing ideas within things that are kind of commonplace, like an object or a place or a person, but you're finding a more universal, deeper thing within them or something.
Yeah.
So that's something that interests me. And another kind of article I'd read before our conversation, someone with the music synesthesia, so they hear the notes and the C shapes. They were saying that they composed their music based on the colours that the notes, the instruments and the notes made them see.
Wow.
But then they realised actually that was kind of a bit ludicrous because they were combining all these strange instruments together and doing work. So they stopped doing that. But what the thing they said that I thought was interesting was, why does someone pick up music in the first place? Well, if you hear see shapes and colours to hear musical sounds, you're immediately getting something else from music.
Yeah.
Someone without synesthesia isn't getting. So, again, there's maybe there's an interest in that, music gives me, there's a visual thing to music as well as an auditory thing with someone with synesthesia. So yeah, maybe you're more likely to pick up certain, I mean, you could talk about all kinds of arts, you know, in fact, cooking, you know, the taste ones we're talking about, people taste things that elicits a color or a shape, or the vice versa. You were saying the language elicits taste. So I don't know, all these things, and maybe what we're talking about now about benefits and stuff, is these things can sometimes be useful in your life, because I mean, certainly for myself, talking about memory and things like that, I remember revising for my A-levels at school. If a certain term or theme I was learning about, you know, the colour of that word, I could write the rest of the revision notes in that colour. So all my revision notes were different colours all over, but I had to remember was the colour green or the colour orange, and then that springboards the whole rest of the concept I was having to remember. So yeah, for me, there have been, and remembering phone numbers actually is quite helpful for me, because I just have to remember a certain section of the numbers, yellow or orange, and I'm like, oh yeah, so it's easier to remember a colour than to remember a series of numbers or something. So another thing I'd read, some people with synesthesia and the music one, they're often pitch perfect, and it's because they can, every single note's a very distinct different colour for them.
Right.
So it's really easy for them to distinguish between notes, because actually the brain is giving them a visual stimulus as well. And actually, I think in that, possibly in that Julia Simmer talk you mentioned, that people with synesthesia are better, well, not, again, not quantifiably better, but more likely to be better at distinguishing between different colours. So you give people two shades of, like 10 shades of red, and they might see 10, and someone else might see 8 different shades or something right. like that. So there's maybe more sensitivity to certain perceptions or something like that. I mean, how about yourself? Are there any kind of, but it's day-to-day or grand.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, so that. I have a very bad memory in some respects. Certainly not something I think of as a strength, and perhaps my particular synesthesia doesn't lend itself to that. Whereas I think, so we are, as you know, renovating a flat at the moment, and there's been a couple of like construction things, and I have no construction training. I didn't study mechanics or engineering or anything like that, and yet I have found that very, very easy. And I wonder if there is an element of the fact that I'm like, especially the monkey bars one, where I'm constantly thinking about angles, and because even though it is something that is decided, I still play with it. I still kind of go, what would happen if I did that? How would that work? Oh no, it doesn't actually work. Blah, blah, blah. So I'm thinking a lot about angles and heights and the way things come together. And I wonder if that has had an impact on how easy I find it to build something in my mind and go, okay, well, that's how it's going to get together and that's how it's going to stay.
I wouldn't be surprised. I think, again, to someone without synesthesia, it's just like, what are you going on about? But like, But you're right. It's just something about how your brain works. I don't know. It's hard to explain it than to say it just is. But
yeah, that just reminded me very, very quickly of a question I thought of and then forgot. When I'm talking about like my calendar synesthesia, and I'm seeing January and it's kind of sweeping down to June and then coming up to, what do you see, if anything, when you think about your calendar?
My own calendar.
Yeah.
Nothing. I mean, I can think of the words like January, June, April, whatever.
Yeah.
And again, I'm seeing them in the synesthesia. It's like the forefront of my head or something. I'm seeing the word, but there's nothing like what you're talking about, this kind of spatial.
Then how do you plan anything? Because this is exactly what my partner said. And they're just like, she's like, I don't know, I maybe see my Google calendar. No, like, what do you mean your Google calendar?
No,
like,
but I think,
don't you have your own?
I think you hit the nail on the head there, maybe, because like, I'm a visual person. So I like to have a diary, and you know, I write everything in the diary, so I can open the diary and I can see the week. But your brain does that for you. You know, you've got an automatic visual calendar inbuilt into your head.
So strange. It's interesting though, because I probably have ADHD, and having a very, very clear calendar, I will check my Google calendar upwards of 40-50 times a day, even if I've only got like two or three things in the calendar. I can't remember them from one minute to the next. So you would think that having this inbuilt calendar, but interestingly, now I think about it, I don't have a very strong one for details of the week.
Yeah.
I can see the shape of the week, like, but I don't have one for my day. And yeah, and that would be really helpful. And I don't have it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah.
I think we're going to draw this to a close. Is there anything else that you're like, I really want to say this about synesthesia before we kind of finish?
I feel like we've talked about a lot. I mean, we could keep talking about it, I'm sure.
Oh my God. But, this is probably going to be the longest episode, and I'm not cutting anything because it is so, I find it so interesting. The listeners are just going to have to power through.
Yeah. Well, I hope if some of your listeners listen to this and like, wait a second, like this is me or something like that, then, you know,
that would be really great. Cool.
Or someone you know or something like that.
Yeah.
Because you're right. To people without synesthesia, it's hard to maybe get into it. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, Julia Simner says that at the beginning of the talk. She like describes a couple of different synesthetes and what they experience. And then she says, I'm going to take a guess that if you are not a synesthete and you're in the audience, you don't believe a single thing I just said.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's true. And our brains are lighting up in different areas. Your color part of the brain is lighting up even when you see black and white, because that, you know, that's happening in my spatial bit of the brain. It's real, goddammit.
Yeah.
Anyway, super grateful for you to come on and choose this topic. And
no, thank you.
It's just perfect
that we both have a connection to it as well. It's not just me talking about it and you going, okay.
Yeah. Okay, sure. Before we finish, Dave, you've got a show coming up at the National Gallery, National Portrait Gallery of Scotland. Mm. Can we just talk for just a few minutes about your art? How would you describe your art to somebody who maybe hasn't been to a show, hasn't seen it?
Well, actually, as it's funny you're saying, do you use synesthesia in your art? All my art is about perception.
Okay.
But not in any relation to synesthesia. Although maybe I should make an artwork about synesthesia. But things like memory or questioning, you know, it's a really simple question. What is something? What's this room? What's this photograph? What's this? And a lot of my work's about, we all have a very individual view of the world, and we often take that for granted. The way you see something is completely different to the way someone else sees something. Or so these, I guess, some interesting things we almost take for granted, which in a way, you know, we took synesthesia for granted in a way, but like not everyone has it. So things that we take for granted or assumptions that we make. And it's the artworks try to, I guess in all my artworks, I present you with something ordinary, like the room you're in, maybe it's the gallery, or it's some photographs, or it's an object, or it's, I mean, the last work you saw of mine, part of it was about where are you, it's just simply asking the question of where are you, but it was actually about how do you know where you are, and everyone's answer to that is quite different. So yeah, present you with something quite ordinary, and then the actual artwork aspect of it, there's something else going on that's trying to take you out of your own shoes a little bit. So the show at the Portrait Gallery, which is kind of really amazing opportunity. So as a member of staff at the National Galleries of Scotland, I've currently got an exhibition on what starts on the 29th of October till the 12th of February, of artworks made by staff at the National Galleries of Scotland. I think there's over 120 artworks in the exhibition.
Wow.
It was open to anyone, so you don't have to, you know, call yourself an artist like I do sometimes. So you know, and I think there's, I mean, I've not seen, you know, I've just dropped my work off, I've not actually seen what's in there, but you know, I think it's gonna be a massive range of stuff from all kinds of people who, you know, do art for different reasons or in different ways. But the work I've made is, I'm also really interested in places, so I've used the actual architecture of the building. I've made an artwork, it's kind of like a little guide to there's a kind of amazing decoration on the ceiling in the portrait gallery of stars of the Northern Hemisphere, which is worth seeing in itself anyway. But I've made an artwork about that decoration, but it's about constellations that aren't included on it, the ones from the Southern Hemisphere. So it's kind of about describing what something is, what is the ceiling of the Portrait Gallery, but by telling you what's not there rather than by telling you what is there. So you'll come into this room when it opens, and yeah, my artwork will be within there. And it's free, you can take it away, it's a little A3 fold-up thing. So,
cool.
Yeah, I'm quite interested in artworks being in places anyone can get a hold of them, like a magazine or a pamphlet or something, rather than necessarily a big installation in a gallery. So so that's what I'm doing.
Fantastic. Yeah, I recommend anyone who is in Edinburgh or passing through Edinburgh in the next couple of months to go and check it out. And as you say, there's going to be a huge range of different stuff in that exhibition. They've also got the permanent exhibition. The architecture of the building itself is stunning. And as is really common in the UK, entrance is free, which I, as somebody who I was thinking about this just the other day because I was walking past the Portrait Gallery, and I just love that galleries and museums in the UK are 99% of the time free, because I can't focus for long enough to justify like an £18 entrance ticket.
Yeah.
But when I go to museums or something in like Spain or Italy, and I'm like, oh God, I've paid for this. I have to like stay and focus on all the artworks, and that's not how I want to enjoy it. I want to enjoy it, walk in, absorb it, and walk out again. So highly recommend people to go there.
Yeah, we are fortunate. I can do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely. All right, that brings us to the end. David, it has been such a pleasure. Sorry about the tech issues, but thank you so much for being patient and coming back to us. We really appreciate it.
Right, no, thank you for having me.
Bye.
Bye.
Wow, what an episode. If the thought of listening to a whole hour-long podcast in English seemed impossible, but you are still with us, that is awesome. You are doing amazingly. Thanks once again to Dave for agreeing to be my guest, for taking the time to research the topic so well, and for sharing his experience. You'll find the link to the lecture we reference, along with a whole bunch of other resources, including the link to the art show Dave is in the episode description. We'll be chatting and sharing our thoughts on this episode over in the Deep Talkers Facebook group. I would love to have you join us there. For now, though, I think that's enough of the sound of my voice in your ears for one day. Thank you so much for listening. I've been Rhiannon. This has been Deep Talk. Have a wonderful day.